You can take your Bibles with me, please, and turn to 1 Samuel chapter 17 this morning as we hear the story of the giant killer. 1 Samuel chapter 17. I want to just read the first 11 verses to give the introduction to the story, what I'm calling a ginormous problem, beginning with verse 1. Now the Philistines gathered their armies for battle, and they were gathered at Succoth, which means belongs to Judah, in a camp between Succoth and Azekah and Ephes Damim. And Saul and the men of Israel were gathered and encamped in the valley of Elah and drew up in line of battle against the Philistines. And the Philistines stood on the mountain of the one side, and Israel stood on the mountain of the other side, with a valley between them. And there came out from the camp of the Philistines a champion named Goliath of Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span, which as best as we can estimate is over 9 foot tall. He had a helmet of bronze of his head, and he was armed with a coat of mail, and the weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels of bronze. And he had bronze armor on his legs and a javelin of bronze slung between his shoulders. That's somewhere over 120 pounds of armor. The shaft of his spear was like a weaver's beam, and his spear's head weighed 600 shekels of iron, and his shield bearer went before him. He stood and shouted to the ranks of Israel, "Why have you come out to draw up for battle? Am I not a Philistine, and are you not servants of Saul? Choose a man for yourselves and let him come down to me. If he is able to fight with me and kill me, then we will be your servants." Just put a P.S. in here. That's actually not true. That's not a promise they're going to follow up on. "But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you shall be our servants and serve us." And the Philistine said, "I defy the ranks of Israel this day. Give me a man that we might fight together." And when Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistines, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. So where we are in the book of Samuel at this point, having seen in the book of Judges, judge after judge after judge, victory given, supernatural power over their enemies over and over, Israel has continued to turn to her sin again and again. Finally, Israel comes up with the solution that if only we had a king like the nations, we could overcome our enemies. So God gives them in Saul a king like the nations, and it does not go well for them. So we saw last week God anoints a man after his own heart from the tribe of Bethlehem, the son of Jesse, by the name of David. David's first words are recorded in this chapter. We read last week that David is recognized. He's anointed secretly just with some of the elders and inhabitants of Bethlehem and Jesse's family. Then he is brought into the royal household, being the right-hand man of Saul, his armor-bearer. He's also his resident musician, court musician, that when the tormenting spirit from God comes and torments Saul, David is able to soothe that spirit. Now, some amount of time has passed. David has been, as I said, already secretly anointed king. This is the first real act of David that's going to show that he is in line with the previous judges, and he's going to be a king in many ways not like the kings of the nations. Now, this episode comes after some period of time where David has been dwelling in the house of Saul. He's been playing music for him. He's been bearing his armor. But we're told in the passage, as we'll look in verse 12 and following, that David has been going back and forth between Saul's household and his father Jesse's household, taking care of sheep. So at this point, David is actually absent from Saul and his army. So the Philistines have gathered up in a battle line. Israel has gathered up with Saul, their king, still recognizes their king in battle line. And this is one of the most well-known stories in the Bible, which makes this an incredible challenge for me. Because how do you tell the story with any interest to people who, or children who have heard the story over and over and over again? We know what it is. We already know the punchline. We already know what's going to happen to him. But I pray that God will give us help to have some insights. And let me just say that the number one moral of the story is not be courageous like David. If we come away merely with that, and we're going to see that there has some merit to it, but if we come away merely saying, okay, we all have our giants we must fight, and we all should be like David and courageous, and we will overcome our giants, we're falling short of what this passage is really wanting us, what the writer is wanting us to see. So in verses 1 through 11, we have this ginormous, this gigantic problem, this man who comes along by the name of Goliath of Gath. As the two are drawn up in battle lines, one of the practices that we see introduced here is that each army will have a representative head of their army come and fight. If they will fight, whoever is the loser will be servants. They will willingly subject themselves and give themselves to the other army. If you've seen the opening scenes of Troy, you know what this looks like in visual cinematic form. So you have a representative head of that nation, usually not the king, but some great warrior. And what a great warrior the Philistines have. This guy is a freak of nature. He is humongous. I did a little research this morning, if you can call reading Wikipedia research. The largest human being that we are aware of, it was a man who lived from 1918 to 1940, at least that we have verifiable evidence besides Goliath, was Robert Wadlow, who is some 8 feet 11 inches. He is the most well-known tall guy in the world. If you look in the Guinness Book of World Records, he's the tallest verifiable so far. He was huge, died at 22 years old with all kinds of physical health problems. By the end of his life, his shoes were something like that big. His hands, his fingers came out to here. He was just, so that gives you at least some awareness of what a guy like Goliath would have been. And he's truly a freak of nature. But this is not a guy who has a degenerative disease like Robert Wadlow, that as he grows, he gets weaker and weaker. This is a full-grown, strong man. Now, he may not be as strong as we think. At least he's intimidating, but this guy is huge. As I've already mentioned, he's over 9 foot, somewhere around 9.5 feet tall. He is carrying some 126 pounds of armor, which he uses well. He is an armor bearer, a shield bearer. So everything that we read about him, we're supposed to read and go, wow, this guy is not just big. This guy is not just really big. This guy is a freak. This guy is head and shoulders above everyone else. And I hope you will notice that by using that phrase, I'm alluding to something we've already seen in the book of Samuel. Who is the guy who is head and shoulders above the rest? It was Saul. Good, good, good way to read your narrative. So we're supposed to be told, we're supposed to read that and imagine how much taller. So Saul was the guy who was a full head and shoulders over everybody else in Israel. But he makes this guy, he makes Saul look like a pipsqueak. So now this is a man that even Saul would have to look up to. So this guy is huge, and he's a real warrior, and he is a real intimidation to Israel. And Israel's response thus far has been, no way. As a matter of fact, we're told in verse 11, when Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. So this man's words was terrifying them. Not his feat, not his deed. They hadn't apparently sent any guy out to try him. Maybe somebody would get lucky. Let's take our best guy and go out there and try this. But they're not even trying at this point. Saul, who thinks a lot of himself, is just trembling in his tent, afraid, and will not even send anybody out. So that's something of the battle scene, this ginormous problem. We're supposed to notice David is missing. We're supposed to notice that David has somehow just disappeared. And at this point in verse 12, we have the reintroduction of David into the narrative. So the last we left him, he's there at the right hand of Saul. He disappears. He goes back to his father's sheep. They line up. This is probably not the next day, the next week, the next month. This is sometime after. They are in the middle of this battle. We're brought right into the middle of the scene. And we're thinking, wow, this is a huge problem. Which then brings us to what I'm calling a shepherd-sized solution. Beginning with verse 12, we'll read verses 12 through 37. Now David was the son of an Ephrathite of Bethlehem in Judah, named Jesse, who had 8 sons. Let me just pause to say that you'll notice there's a reintroduction of David here as if we've not been introduced to him before. The reason I think that takes place is some of these stories could have functioned as individual narrative stories that would have been told to children and to others. Remember, everybody during this time, during biblical times, was not literate. So not only would they read through the entirety of the book, sometimes you have the reiteration of certain key things that you need to know in the story so that that story could stand all by itself. So even if you didn't have anything prior to chapter 17, you could read this as an individual story and it would make sense. You would know who David was. I think that's why these things are repeated here. Again, verse 12. He had 8 sons, and in the days of Saul, the man was already old and advanced in years. Speaking of Saul. The 3 oldest sons of Jesse, which we've already been introduced to in the previous chapter, had followed Saul to the battle. And the names of his 3 sons who went to the battle were Eliab the firstborn, the next to him Abinadab, and the 3rd Shammah. David was the youngest. The 3 eldest followed Saul, but David went back and forth from Saul to feed his father's sheep at Bethlehem. So there we're told explicitly, the 3 oldest boys, apparently David is too young to serve in the army or is not needed at this point. But he goes back and forth taking care of his father's sheep because all the other sons are soldiers, right? So then he's going to go back to take care of the sheep. He's going to feed his father's sheep at Bethlehem. For 40 days, now suddenly we have this, and you'll see this several times in the narrative. Some stuff's told about David, then it shoots back to the battlefield. Comes back, talks about David, zoom, shoots back, and keeps coming back to where the Philistine, where Goliath is. Verse 16, for 40 days the Philistine came forward, took a stand morning and evening. So David is out in the fields. He probably doesn't have messengers going back and forth. There is this terrifying giant standing before the Israelites. They are shrinking back, and David's out taking care of sheep. As I've emphasized several times through this series, where is the work of God? Where is it going on? Where is God working? And sometimes it's in some of the most strange places. I mean, where's the great warrior? He's out taking care of the sheep. Verse 17. And Jesse said to David, his son, take your brothers an ephah of this parched grain and these 10 loaves and carry them quickly to the camp to your brothers. He's taking it out there to feed them the way that they would be fed in the field. Sometimes they would take food with them. They didn't have preservatives. They didn't have refrigerators to carry stuff in. Sometimes you got to replenish the army. Who's going to do that? Well, they don't have a lot of time. Well, these guys actually do, but they don't have a lot of place to harvest. They can plunder a little bit, but the family's going to take care of them. So David is called to go to the camp to his brothers. Verse 18, also take these 10 cheeses to the commander of their 1,000. Going to take care of the upper guy as well. See if your brothers are well and bring some tokens from them. So go to them, see how they're doing. I haven't heard anything. Send them to the field. Verse 19. Now Saul and they and all the men of Israel were in the valley of Elah fighting with the Philistines. Reiteration. We already know that. He's just going back in the narrative in this way. Verse 20. And David rose up early in the morning, left the sheep with the keeper, took the provisions and went as Jesse had commanded him. And he came to the encampment as the host was going out to the battle line, shouting the war cry. Now, I think there's a little bit of humor here because, let's go get them. They come up to the battle line and there's Goliath. And they all stop. And David comes on this scene. I got here just in time. All right. You bunch of circumcised, no good for nothings, waiting who's your God? And then David's standing there watching this. So they go out with this battle cry. David rises early. He arrives there, verse 21, and Israel and the Philistines drew up for battle, army against army. And David left the things in charge of the keeper of the baggage, ran to the ranks, and went and greeted his brothers. Hey, bros, what's going on? Eliab, Aminadab, how's it going? Shammah, how's it going? Verse 23, and as he talked with them, behold, the champion, the Philistine of Gath, Goliath by name, came up out of the ranks of the Philistines. Again, I think Troy, that opening scene, is he just plows out from between them. Here he comes. And spoke the same words as before. So everything that he has said before, where's your champion? Send your champion down. I'll fight him. We'll be your servants. You be our servants. And David sees all this. And it says he came out and David heard him. Verse 24, all the men of Israel, when they saw the man, fled from him. So again, I think this is funny, sort of. They see him, they run up, battle cry, they flee from him, and were much afraid. And the men of Israel said, have you seen this man who has come up? Surely he has come up to defy Israel. And the king will enrich the man who kills him with great riches and will give him his daughter and make his father's house free in Israel. Hey, there's some benefits to killing this guy. Man, not only, you know, there's not a lot about the Lord's name. There's not a lot here about we will vindicate that God is the true God. It's just like, you know, not only will you eliminate this threat, but I tell you what, some good things will happen out of this. Verse 26, and David said to the men who stood by him, what shall be done for the man who kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? For who is? And I think there's a little bit of a wordplay here is, he's essentially saying, what do you mean he's going to get something out of this? What shall be done for the man? For who is this uncertain? What is that? What are you guys talking about? Hey, you know, if any of us get brave enough, man, you've got retirement for the rest of your life. Your family's taken care of and it'll be all right. He's like, what are you talking about? Who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? Now, let me pause to say, these are the first words we have from David in the Bible. Isn't that cool? He snuck up on you, didn't he? I mean, he's been in the narrative. He was anointed. He's been singing to Saul. But we don't have a single word from David. He's been the quiet guy in the background until he steps up and apparently a relatively young guy. He's got all these older brothers, big warriors, season. He's never apparently been in battle in this way. And he steps up, though he is called a man of valor earlier, a man of war. How did they know that? So he steps up and he says, what is going on here? They are, our God is alive. You're acting as if there's no God. Our gods aren't like their gods. Their gods are idols. They're dead. They have eyes, but they can't see. Our God sees. He makes the eyes. And unless we get on the, yeah, what's wrong with these stupid Israelites? How often do we come to our challenges, our problems, our sin, acting the same way? How often we come to the things that frustrate us or disappoint us and act as if our God is not the living God? I mean, is he an idea? Is he a principle? Is he a theology? Or is he a God who is living and sovereign and in control and orchestrating your life so that you respond by saying, God is alive. I'm going to act as if God is alive in my life instead of, what am I going to do about this? Well, where's God? Well, he's kind of over there somewhere doing something, but he's really not connected here. So we're supposed to look at the Israelites and go, man, that's an awful lot like me. I need somebody who's going to step up for me. I need someone who's going to be bold and a representative for me against this man, against this monster. So David's first and foremost passion isn't what do I get out of this? What are the benefits by way of retirement? The question is, we represent God. We represent the living God. And who is this guy? And if you read back through the passage, I won't take time to do it now, but this word defy is repeated 6 times through this chapter. Defy, defy, defy. This is all about Goliath's defiance of God is ultimately what this is about. This one who's going to defy God and David's overcoming the one who defies God as a representative for his evil army. So verse 27. And the people answered him in the same way. So shall it be done to the man who kills him. Here's what I think is happening. He goes, so what will happen to that man? Well, he's going to get all this stuff. Well, what is that? We have the living God. And they go, but you get all this stuff. Yeah, he does. They are not going to be able to do this. So verse 28. OK, so Let me point out here, David has at least three opposers in this story. Three people who oppose him. We think of Goliath, but there are two guys on the way up to Goliath he's going to be opposed by. The first is his oldest brother, Eliab. The second is Saul. And the third is Goliath himself. Don't miss that. The bad guy, the opposer of David, is not just Goliath. It's these other guys. Here's the first one, verse 28, Eliab. Now, Eliab, his eldest brother, we know how older brothers can be. Eliab, his eldest brother, heard when he spoke to the men. So here's this relatively young kid come in from the sheep. Here's this, and he's talking. He's like, hey, now I don't think we should think little kid, just relatively young guy, probably in his mid-20s, something around there. He's like, well, what's going on here? Oh, this is the living God. And Eliab walks up and is like, that's David. What's going on here? Eliab's anger was kindled against David, and he said, why have you come down? And with whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness? Ugh! That you need to see that as a verbal jab. You're a little punk. Do you know what you are? You're a keeper of a few sheep in the wilderness. You are nobody. Man, you're a humble little, you're not going to be able to do anything. Why are you up here? Blah, blah, blah. Listen, kid, go home. With whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know your presumption and the evil of your heart. He goes from being insulting to omniscient. I know why you're here. I can read your heart. I know the motives of your heart. Your presumption, the evil of your heart, for you have come down to see the battle. You're a rubbernecker, is what you are. You're the guy that drives past accidents and can't help but taking a look, you know? So you came down here just to be a spectator. How ironic, because we know what's going to happen. No, he's going to be the one you're looking at really soon. Eliab, older brother, smart guy, omniscient one. Verse 29, and David said, what have I done now? Was it not but a word? Here's a brother rivalry going on. If you can't see that, I mean, this is funny. What have I done now? I'm just talking to these guys. What's wrong with you? And he turned away from him toward another and spoke in the same way, and the people answered him again as before. So he's like, look, why are we letting this uncircumcised guy? Well, we'll get a lot of stuff if we beat him. What are you talking about? So there's opposition, opposer number one. Verse 31, when the words that David spoke were heard, they repeated them before Saul, and he sent for him. So they're talking. Saul is apparently in his tent or somewhere else, and they came and they said, you know who's here? It's David. And he's stirring it up with the troops. And so Saul says, bring him here. I mean, he's in all in. He's the only guy that's really upset about this. A lot of guys are afraid. Not too many of them are angry about this. And David said to Saul, verse 32, let no man's heart fail because of him. Your servant will go and fight with this Philistine. I love that. Okay, everybody. You guys are all freaked out. You guys are all afraid. You guys are all trembling. You tell the guys, calm down. You tell them to let not their heart fail because of this guy. Your servant, I'll go. I'll go and fight with this Philistine. Here's the second opposition, verse 33. And Saul said to David, you are not able. So he's been told he's a nobody. He's been told he's just a keeper of sheep. He's been told he's a nibby nose. He's been told that he's just a proud of heart guy. Now, Saul just says, you can't, son. You can't do this. You're not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him. For you are but a youth, and he has been a man of war from his youth. I mean, this guy has been trained in the best Philistine fighting schools possible. I mean, imagine, give me an MMA top champion fighter right now. No, not right now. I mean, right now. It sounded a little demanding. I didn't mean to be demanding. Right now, who's a top fighter? Anderson Silva steps into the room and says, I'm going to take everybody down. And we've seen him fight, perhaps, I haven't. We've seen him fight, and Ross steps up and says, I'll take him. Ross, look, we know you've had some Taekwondo lessons and everything. We've seen that, but this isn't the same. He's like, no, I'll take him. And we realize he's serious. And Ross says, well, you say, what? Ross, you can't do that. And he says, this guy's coming in to find God. Why aren't any of you doing to this? He'll kill us. That's why. Ross says, I don't care. He's defying God. This is an uncircumcised Philistine. This is God he's ultimately defying, and I serve the living God. But he's been trained. This Silva guy, he's been trained. He's been working out. I mean, he's broken, you know, metal bars that are thicker than you. You know, just, you can't, that doesn't matter. But what's interesting is that his experience does play a part, but in a very unusual way. Verse 34, David says to Saul, your servant used to keep sheep for his father. And when there came a lion or a bear and took a lamb from the flock, I went after him and struck him and delivered it out of its mouth. Now, let me just say, that's no small thing. I mean, this isn't like, you know, well, I played putt-putt golf one time, therefore I'm ready for the Masters. Now, this guy has taken lions and bear in hand. So his experience is very different. But man, this is a kid. This is a kid who loves his sheep and is willing to go at the jowls of a fierce monster to save and pull those sheep out of their mouth. And it's almost as if David is like, I can do this. I can do this. When there came a lion or a bear, okay, well, maybe it was a little lion or a little bear he's talking about. You know, okay, diminish it so it doesn't mean anything. That's not what he's talking about. He's like, look, I've got some skill in this. I caught him by his beard. I struck him and killed him. If he rose against me. Verse 36, your servant has struck down both lions and bears, and this uncircumcised, he loves that term, by the way. This uncircumcised, okay, didn't need that visual image, thank you. This Philistine shall be like one of them, for he has defied the armies of the living God. You see, again, he's like, I've got some skill in this area, but this isn't ultimately about my skill. This is about God is living. And if I've got some skills, God is the one who enabled me to do that. And if God enables me to do that, God will enable me to do this. So it's not, I got this, I'm so skilled, man, I've had more Taekwondo lessons than you realize. It's like, no, if I can do this here that God has enabled me to do, God will enable me to do this here because it's His hand that has delivered me as I delivered the lions, the sheep from the lambs, the lambs from the lions. So Saul says, you're not able. He says, I can because he has defied the living God. Verse 37, and David said, the Lord, here's his clearly, explicitly theological reason for fighting this giant. The Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and from the paw of the bear will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine. So again, it's not my skill. I got skill. But it's skill that God has given me and God will enable me to do this. So, what is Saul going to do? Saul said to David, go and the Lord be with you. Was that sincere? Was it a talisman, verbal talisman to kind of cover, hedge? I don't know. But regardless, the Lord was with him. So that is a shepherd-size solution. Three opponents, Eliab, Saul, insulting, you can't do anything. But notice, though he has a point, opponents, his motivation is the living God's glory, and his confidence is the living God's power. We're going to come back to that in application later. Number three, here it comes. A faith-filled fight. Verse 38. Then Saul clothed David with his armor. He put a helmet of bronze on his head and clothed him with a coat of mail. And David strapped his sword over his armor, and he tried in vain to go, for he had not tested them. Then David said to Saul, I cannot go with these, for I have not tested them. So David put them off. So Saul, David's his armor bearer. There's also some irony here. I will give you my armor. I am the king. Here's an opportunity to go to fight as the king, to be identified as the king. David might look very much like Saul from a distance in Saul's armor. It doesn't fit him. He hasn't tested it. And so there's all kinds of spiritual applications that are sometimes drawn out of this. I just think it comes down to, it doesn't fit me. I can't fight in this. It's not the right size. So he takes it off, verse 40. Then he took his staff in his hand, his shepherd's staff, and he chose 5 smooth stones from the brook. So where is the deliverance of God? A kid looking for rocks. It's a little small. Yeah, that won't be all right. Okay. So there he is. Goliath's out there. Come on, everybody. They're all trembling, and he's looking for rocks. And he put him in his shepherd's pouch. His sling was in his hand and he approached the Philistine. So imagine this. Now we go to the Goliath cam. Goliath, head and shoulders above everybody else, looking down. There's the army up there. These guys are trembling and rah, 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 and he's turning back, chuckling to his buddies. Oh, these stupid Israelites. Yeah, yeah. And then he sees a kid with no armor coming out in shepherd's clothing with a staff. Maybe not even seeing his sling. Walking up. Is this some kind of joke? Verse 41, and the Philistine moved forward and came near to David with his shield bearer in front of him. So he comes, like he needs him, he thinks, right? He comes up, steps up, here he is, here's their great champion. And when the Philistine looked and saw David, he disdained him. What? No, this got to be some joke. This is a kid. He was but a youth. He was ruddy and handsome in appearance. Even Goliath apparently knows. That's kind of a handsome guy, but he's still small. And the Philistine said to David, am I a dog that you come to me with sticks? I don't think he saw it. He's got a stick, right? Staff. Can't do much. You can't throw that thing. You can't get very close. I mean, you can't do much of that at a long distance. You come in with me with sticks. And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. May Baal curse you, you good for nothing Israelite, circumcised, false god worshiper. And the Ashtoreth curse you from the high heavens and the depths of Hades. And David's sitting there listening as this barrage of words comes. He's cursing him. The Philistine, when he was done with his little tirade, the Philistine said to David, come to me and I will give your flesh to the birds of the air and to the beasts of the field. Man, I hope you can picture this. Come on over here. Soon the birds will be coming and picking flesh off your bones, boy. Then David said to the Philistine, you come to me with a sword and with a spear and with a javelin. But I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. You are trusting in your weapons. And while I have weapons, I'm not trusting in them. This isn't about my skill. This isn't about my weaponry. This isn't about the stones that I've chosen. So, you know, I've heard about sermons, you know, he chose 5 stones. And so we've got to choose our 5 stones of strategic planning. That's just dumb. Sorry, it's just dumb. This isn't about the 5 smooth stones. This is about a guy who's trusting in God through whatever instrumentality he's going to have at hand. You come to me with all this stuff and you think these are going to deliver you. No, I'll tell you what's going to happen. God is going to deliver me from this. And then he does a little prophesying. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hand. Because God is living, he's involved here. This is the living God. This is God who's looking down from heaven right now, and he sees me, and he sees you, and he knows that I can't take you, but he's going to act, and he's going to give you into my hand, and you know what's going to happen? I will strike you down and cut off your head. I'm sure Goliath is like, all right, man, you're going to get it now, kid. And I will give the dead bodies of the host of the Philistines this day. Not just you, the host of the army is going to die and feed these birds you said would feed on my flesh. And to the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. And that all this assembly may know that the Lord saves not with sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's and He will give you into our hand. That's what's going to happen here. That's what's getting ready to happen here, man. God's getting ready to throw down. And you're all going to be thrown down. They're going to be feeding on your flesh. So what's interesting is the battle itself is much shorter than the speech, which I think is, well, I know, is intentional. We're supposed to, more than the battle, it's what theologically are we being taught? I mean, it's cool. That's great, but that's not as important as what David has just said. Verse 48, when the Philistine arose and came and drew near to meet David, David ran quickly toward the battle line to meet his Philistine. Oh, man. He picks up the pace, starts running after him. You know how hard it is to hit something with a weapon while you're running? Just saying. David put his hand in his bag, took out a stone, slung it and struck the Philistine on his forehead. The stone sank into his forehead and he fell on his face to the ground. He's running. He's swell, bonk, and I'm going to say from the passage, he kills him twice. I don't think it's, you can't kill somebody twice, but the passage tells us he killed him twice. Watch. Verse 50. So David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and with a stone and struck the Philistine and killed him. Dead, right? There was no sword in the hand of David. Then David ran and stood over the Philistine and took his sword and drew it out of his sheath and killed him. Man, this guy's doubly dead. This is the guy we were talking about earlier. Ain't going to get up in the end. There's not going to be a little jerking of his hand. He stands up. Oh, you know, should have done it. He's double killing him. He drew his own sword. He killed him by his own weapon. I think probably the whole is the scene is summarized. He killed him with the sword or with the stone. Ultimately, his death, he is undone. There's no hope for him once the sword, his own sword, his own instrument of death is used on him. So he drew his sword. He drew it out of its sheath. That's going to become, as we'll see, a trophy of David's. Killed him and cut off his head with it. Probably stabbed him to relieve his suffering. Then cut off his head. When the Philistines saw that their champion was dead, did they do what they said they were going to do? We'll be your servants. Oh dear. If a shepherd kid can do that to him, there may very, very well be a God with them that we don't have, and we got to get out of here now. They fled. Verse 52, and the men of Israel... He did it! He did it! Eliab, your brother did it! Oh, wait, they're running away, let's go! And they take off after him. After them. And the men of Israel and Judah rose with a shout, yeah! Pursued the Philistines as far as Gath and the gates of Ekron, so that the wounded Philistines fell on the way from Sha'araim as far as Gath and Ekron, and the people of Israel came back from chasing the Philistines, and they plundered their camp. They just fled, left all their camps set up, ran off, went and killed them, came back, took all their stuff. And David took the head of the Philistine and brought it to Jerusalem. And he put his armor in his tent. So he keeps all this bronze, this 120 pounds of bronze. Probably could be used for some other things. I doubt David's going to grow into it. But he takes his head. The head. Verse 55, as soon as Saul saw David go out against the Philistine, he said to Abner, the commander of the army, Abner, whose son is this youth? And Abner said, as your soul lives, O king, I do not know. Now, just take a minute. I don't want it to be too distracting. Why does he ask this question? Does he ask this question? And on rereading the text, he doesn't say, who is this boy? You'd say, okay, Saul's losing his mind or he's insane. I think I suggested that last week. But that's not really the question he asks. He doesn't say, who is this? I've never seen this guy before. Oh, he's the guy that's playing music for you. You may recognize him, David. No, he says specifically, whose son is this youth? In other words, he's not coming from a noble family. Yes, when he gained permission for David to come into his household, he sent messengers, we're told back in the last chapter, requesting permission to keep him. But for what happens in back in verse 25, the king will enrich the man who kills him with great riches and will give him his daughter and make his father's house free in Israel. He's inquiring to the father of David so that he has a sense this guy's going to do it, and he has done it, and I need to find out who his father is. So if he's not a free man, he will be free in Israel. That's what I think is going on here. So he's keeping with his promise. It's a secondary benefit, but he does follow through with that promise. And the king said, inquire whose son the boy is. Verse 57, as soon as David returned from the striking down of the Philistine, Abner took him and brought him before Saul with the head of the Philistine in his hand. Got a present for you, a present for you, king. And Saul said to him, whose son are you, young man? And David answered, I am the son of your servant Jesse, the Bethlehemite. And so we're supposed to go full circle back to the anointing of David, and we start going, this is the guy. This is the guy. Been there with the king. Samuel anointed him privately. He's been doing his work as a shepherd and as a musician, friend, armor bearer of Saul. In the field, he comes. He's the champion. And by the way, just so you don't miss it, this is Jesse, the son of Jesse, the Bethlehemite. This is the king. So we've seen a faith-filled fight and verses 55 through 58, what I'm calling a proper identification of David and of his household. So looking back on it, what are we supposed to get from this story? Let's start with David, then let's move to Jesus, and let's move to us. And you're going to see that it's the same pattern, briefly. What do we see about David? David, on the way to accomplishing what God wants him to accomplish, finds obstacles. The obstacles of his brother, obstacle of Saul, obstacle of Goliath himself. On his way to becoming king, there are these obstacles. His motivation in this whole scene is the name and the glory of God. That's what's motivating him. That's why he wants to do this. Not for the benefits to his family, not because of his crown, not because he thinks, oh, I can become king out of this. This is about the name of God. This is the man after God's own heart. The man after God's own heart is the man after God's own glory. And we need to ask ourselves that question. Am I a man? Am I a woman after God's heart? Well, what does that mean? It means I want God magnified. It means when God is ridiculed, my heart breaks. It means I want my motivation to be the glorification of God, particularly now, the name of Jesus. But notice, thirdly, his confidence was in God's power. What enabled him to overcome his older brother was the power of God, what God had done in his life, able to overcome Saul's statement, you can't do it, and Goliath saying, you're losing, man. You're going to be fed to the birds. It was God's power that gave David confidence, not David's own abilities. So there's David, which speaks of David's son, greater than David, the son of David, the one who will take David's throne, Jesus Christ. He also has obstacles on the way to fulfilling God's will. Think about how many obstacles. One, he's born of a woman in the likeness of sinful flesh. He becomes a man in a sinful world. He's born into what appears to be a relatively impoverished family. This doesn't appear to be the family of a king, just like Jesse and David and the Bethlehemites, born in Bethlehem. All right. He's got opposition at his birth. He is, as I said last week, the first boy who lived. Attempting to kill him, he escaped, and he was the boy who lived, who will become the one who would sacrifice his life for redemption. All along the way, Jesus has parents who at some point in his ministry are saying, we think he's out of his mind. Which makes me think they were out of their mind because of all that had gone before. But his mother and brothers come and say, he's out of his mind. Call him out of the house. Jesus has the opposition of his own disciples. They've got a different agenda for him, and he keeps correcting them. And then when he says, well, oh, by the way, I'm going to the cross, Peter says, no! No, you can't do that. No. He says, shut up and get behind me, Satan. That's enough. He's got the opposition of the leaders, both Jewish and the Roman leadership. So, obstacles. What is Jesus' motivation through it all? I've come to glorify your name. He came to show that there was a living God who cared and loved for people and humanity and redemption enough that he himself, in the person of his Son, would come and die on a cross to redeem us. Why? Because, as Ben mentioned earlier, that he just saw something beautiful in us. And he saw through all of our muck and said, but there's something good about them, and I want to redeem them. And once I put them in a dress and get them cleaned up and they're put in a different environment, they'll see how really good that they are. That's not Jesus' motivation. The motivation for our redemption is the glory of God. And we should be glad that it's in that order. Because if it was my beauty or my holiness or my good intentions, that's not a motivation strong enough to sustain Jesus to save me. It's only his devotion to the Father, his devotion and motivation to God's name. And what is the confidence of Jesus? It's only the power of God. There's not this sense that he goes, you know, guys, I got this. Don't worry. You know, I've got skills. I am God in the flesh. It's okay. What does he do when he comes to tough times? He's out praying. What does the God-man have to pray for? He doesn't have any sin, so that confession part of prayer is going to be real short. Father, forgive me for nothing. You can just skip right over that part. But what is his confidence? He's going and saying, God, Father, I can't do this without you. I need you to strengthen me. I need you to empower me. I need you to give me your spirit. I need you to help me. I am a man. Yes, he is God too, but he's a man. He's strengthened in the wilderness after 40 days because he is weak and hungry as a man. He's tired on the boat and sleeping. And he's praying and he has God's power. And finally, when he gets to the end and he's in the garden, he is essentially saying, I can't. And if there's any other way to do this, please do it. Nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done. So Jesus isn't, and the way the prophet puts it is, his voice was not heard in the street. He was always heard in the street. But Jesus wasn't this cocky guy walking around going, I got this, I got this, no problem. He is a humble, dependent, saying, this is the power of God in me. So his confidence was God's power. So we see in David, but a dim, still fairly bright reflection of Christ, who overcame obstacles in the name of God as his motivation and the power of God. I mean, what more confidence can you have is, if you kill me, God's going to raise me from the dead. So kill me as a sacrifice, and God will raise me from the dead. That's pretty strong confidence in God's power. So we're supposed to see this image of our Savior, which brings us then to, well, what about motivation? What about the morals of the story? What can we learn? I don't agree that we just have to leave it there. Okay, so it's talking about Jesus, and that's the only thing. We're terrible at this stuff, so there's Jesus, and that's all. I don't think that's true, because I don't think the Bible, the New Testament, treats things like this in that way. And here's why. For instance, look over at the book of Hebrews. What do we learn from this? What are we encouraged? Notice over in the book of Hebrews, and we'll close with this morning. In Hebrews chapter 11, verse 32, referring to many of these other guys, including David. What more shall I say? For time would fail me to tell of Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, of David and Samuel and the prophets, who through faith conquered kingdoms, enforced justice, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the power of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, were made strong out of weakness, became mighty in war, put foreign armies to flight. Women received back their dead from resurrection by resurrection. Some were tortured, refusing to accept release so that they might rise again to a better life. Others suffered mockings, floggings, and even chains and imprisonments. They were stoned. They were sawn in two. They were killed with a sword. They went about in skins and sheeps and goats, of destitute, afflicted, mistreated, of whom the world was not worthy, wandering about in deserts and mountains and in dens and caves of the earth. And of all these, though commended through their faith, did not receive what was promised, since God had provided something better for us, that apart from us, they should not be made perfect. Now, here's his application. As he's already told us in verse 1 of chapter 11, faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. By faith we understand this. Without faith, it's impossible to please God. He gives all of these examples. Then he says, chapter 12, therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, including this man David that we just saw, he's one of the witnesses standing, what are we to do? I don't think it's accurate to say, realize that Jesus did what we can't do and just leave it there. It's true. We start there. Absolutely. Without that, we say, man, Jesus was all these guys wrapped up, take all the bad stuff out, and then magnified 1,000 times and more. And that's Jesus. But seeing that we have a guy like David, seeing that we're so surrounded by such a great cloud, let us also lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely. Let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. So Jesus is the ultimate example of that faith. Why? Because he faced off toe-to-toe with the devil. And according to Hebrews chapter 1, through death he killed him who had the power of death. You know what? I'll put it this way. He took the sword out of Satan's hand and conquered him with it. What power does Satan have? Death. Jesus took death out of his hand, died, and through death overcame him who had the power of death. Jesus is our David, our warrior, our giant killer. What does that leave for us? Coming back to the historical narrative, we looked down on the field and saw David slay Goliath. Impossible to do. And he turns around and he holds up the devil's head. And we run onto the field. Why? Because we think, oh, no, we got this. But we say, that's our leader. That's our new captain. As humble as he is, humble shepherd-like man from Bethlehem, despised in the eyes of others. There's nothing that we would look at him and desire him as our king, yet he overcomes the devil for which we cry out the battle cry and march forward for the living God. Obstacles? Yep, we'll have them. But what is our motivation? God's name, God's glory, the glory of Christ. And what is our confidence? God's power. To use us as he wills, to use our meager abilities and gifts to do something larger than ourselves. So let us look to Christ, but by grace, let us charge on to the field and follow our captain and our king. Let's pray, please. Heavenly Father, part of the gospel call is for us, following Jesus, to cry out onto that other side of the battlefield and invite a treason and a betrayal against their captain to come on the side of Jesus. And there may be some here today who need to make that defection from the army of the one who has been defeated and to run to Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith. So if there are any here this morning without Christ, please may they defect right now, because their champion has been defeated. Their representative head has been cast down. And may they run to that one from Bethlehem who was God in the flesh, raised from the dead, and who is coming again. Lord, help us as we've heard to face the obstacles of our own flesh, of the world, of the devil, with the desire to see your name magnified and with confidence that even if we are slain in the process, you will raise us from the dead by your power. In Christ's name we ask. Amen.